Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, and we have a great cast for you tonight. My guest tonight is from Untamed. She is the creative director. Please welcome to the cast, Julia Karen Dietar.
Hi.
Hi, Julia. It's a pleasure to have you on the cast today.
It's great to be here.
Yep. It's a pleasure to have you, Julia. So, to begin with, since this is your first time on the cast, for people who may not know what Untamed is, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and the studio?
Sure. So Untamed is an indie game studio located in Brooklyn, New York. It was started by my husband probably in 2008, and it was just him for a number of years, and I recently joined, and now it's just him and me, basically. And as for me, I was working at a game studio in the city for a number of years. It's a casual game studio called Arcadian. Mm-hmm. And last year I decided to join Itai full-time and help him with our upcoming game, Mushroom 11.
Cool. Now, what is Mushroom 11 for people who are listening?
Mushroom 11 is a kind of experimental puzzle platformer, mm-hmm. where you control this green amorphous blob by deleting parts of it. And as you delete parts of it, it grows back simultaneously. The game actually came out of a game jam several years ago. And Itai has been, my husband, he's been working on it for several years. And we have a friend who's doing the art, and I'm just joined last year to help out with design and PR and marketing and additional art and all that sort of stuff.
Awesome. I was watching the trailer footage for Before the Cast, and it looks very interesting. So the idea is that you're trying to get like the main part of this blob through the level, but you do have to essentially delete as much as you can sort of to like fit around or get around the obstacles.
Yeah, it's an interesting way because you don't have any direct control over the blob. Mm-hmm. You're sort of trimming it and pruning it and trying to encourage it to go where you want it to go. It sounds pretty complicated, but it's actually really intuitive. It's like pushing Play-Doh around or clay around in a sort of a digital sense.
Now, you said that this idea was sort of started at a game jam a few years ago by your husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the Global Game Jam of 2012, and the theme was a snake eating its tail. Mm. The idea just sort of came out from there. We didn't have this idea beforehand, mm-hmm. just sort of came out of the game jam.
Yep, and that's a story we hear from a lot of developers about how they go to these game jams, or they have these like play sessions, or these just like brainstorming parts, and this idea can sort of be given birth from that and then extrapolate out to a full game.
Yeah, I feel like the game jam really helps developers think of creative ideas, because if you create a box, then it's easier to think out of it. Mm-hmm. It's really like any other art form. When you're staring at a blank canvas, it can be really intimidating, and people always want to make this like amazing huge game, but actually, if you limit yourself to, you know, time and theme, it becomes easier to think of things you never would have thought of if you just were able to, like, oh, I'm just going to sit down and make this really great, awesome game. You kind of get stuck. Whereas if you're like, okay, I only have, you know, 12 hours in this theme of, like, I don't know, you know, what was the Ludum Dare theme, was like a one screen game. It just sort of forces you to think differently about games and really helps come up with cool ideas.
Yeah, and that is a really great point, Julia. And that's something that I know I've had experience. I've done a few game jams back in the day, and then I tried working on a project with people. And one of the biggest hurdles, I think, is having to, you know, force to limit yourself in your thinking or in what you're trying to do. Because it's very easy to sit there and say, oh, I'm going to develop the next Grand Theft Auto 5, you know, 200 hours of gameplay, super realistic graphics, and then when it's time to actually put that down on paper and the computer, it's like, what the hell am I supposed to be doing?
Yeah. It's really easy to get very complicated, but it's very hard to be really simple, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and some of the best ideas we've seen from the indie developer movement over the last few years have been these ideas that are deceptively simple. Like, they don't look like something that you can't really put next to, like, a Skyrim or Grand Theft Auto, but they have a really solid foundation, and it just grows out from there. I would say some great examples would be stuff from like Clay Entertainment with Don't Starve, a frequent fan of the podcast, Chris Park with Arkham Games. These are developers who take a basic foundation, they limit themselves in a specific way, and then they grow it from there, as opposed to, you know, starting with the kitchen sink approach and then trying to, you know, cut out whatever they can't make work.
Right, and that's so much harder than it seems. Like, even the most simple games just take so long to get elegant and to get right. Threes is a great example of a game that just is so elegant and beautiful, but it took a long time to get to that point because it's just so hard to, you know, cut back and find simple, you know, UI and UX decisions for your game and also making it fun.
Yeah. Now, with Mushroom 11, as we talked about before the podcast, it will be available both for the PC and mobile phones, correct?
Yeah, it'll be available for PC, Mac, and Linux first. It will be available around the spring. And for mobile, it'll be available in the fall.
Cool. Now, since you're developing it for these two very different platforms, have that sort of led to any design decisions or control UI philosophies for Mushroom 11?
Yeah, actually, the original Game Jam was developed for Touch, the Game Jam game, and we came upon like a ton of design problems. Actually, the reason why the game goes from right to left as a platformer, which is kind of backwards from most platformers, is because if you play on the touch screen, most people are right-handed, and if you go from left to right, then you basically block your entire view.
Yeah.
And it's very hard. So we actually switched it. And we decided to just focus on desktop for now, but we kind of kept that going from right to left because we knew that would be an issue when we moved it back to tablets. Now, for left-handed people, for tablets anyway, we're going to have like a left-handed mode where we just sort of flip everything the other way around so people can play it.
Yep, and as a great coincidence, you're talking to a lefty right now.
Yeah, exactly. So it's something that is really weird because you don't have to think about this on the computer, but when you move to tablets, you do have to think about it, and it just really makes such a big difference. Just the direction of where you know you're going affects your ability to like play the game.
Yep, and that is a very interesting discussion. We see this also with like handhelds, like the Nintendo 3DS, the PlayStation Vita. When you start implementing touchscreen controls and you have to start thinking about how the person's going to be controlling that, that really does add another wrinkle to the proceedings.
Well, it's like super complicated, actually. So one of the first games we made, Rope Rescue, is this puzzle game for tablet and mobile. And the sort of first lesson we learned not to do for our next game was not to develop it for desktop. So we were, you know, originally we had it tested on the tablet, but then as the game progressed in development, we just sort of switched over to always playing it in the editor on the computer. We sort of lost touch of like how this game actually plays on a touch screen. And it's just so important because it takes a game and adds this whole other layer and can make something that's really great turn it into something that's like not very playable because your finger's too big or the position of how you're moving stuff is really awkward or your hand cramps after a time and you have to like kind of drop your device or switch hands. So just all these different factors we don't think about are really important.
Definitely. An example that I've had to deal with in the past was the 3DS title Kid Icarus Uprising. This was a action game for the system and had one of the most like obtuse controls I've seen. It combined touchscreen with the circle pad with button controls and the whole thing. As you said, Julia, when you start having to implement these touch controls and you're not understanding, you know, how the person's holding the system, it becomes a major pain in the ass to play it correctly. Mm. And even for me, I mean, I love the game, but I could really only play for like 20, 30 minutes before my hand just seriously started to hurt like hell. And that's something you really don't want to happen with, you know, any type of mobile or touchscreen oriented game.
Yeah, I mean, even trying to factor in all the various ways people touch or use or hold a device is just also really variant. I guess especially if you're doing casual games, or if you're making casual games, because people always just find the weirdest way to like interact. I mean, some people hold the tablet and like will flick with their finger. Some people will like hold it and use their thumbs. It's just so all over the place. It's really like it's a challenge.
Yep, definitely. Now for you and your studio, Julia, are there any other like games or genres that both of you like to play like in your spare time?
Oh, I'm sort of all over the place. I think Itai is probably also all over the place. I know some of my favorite games have actually been really old casual games. I do play a lot of casual games. I can't really enjoy first person shooters, and neither can Itai, because we both get nauseous after a while. So it, unfortunately, that limits the games we can play. So a lot of first person shooters or first person adventure, click and adventure games is difficult for us. But we love board games, we love regular games, I mean card games, physical games, all sorts of games.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that you brought up about the first-person motion sickness, because that's something that I hear from a lot of developers and a lot of people who play games, that kind of issue. For me, I've never really had that, although I will say that 3D effects has been like the one thing that bothers me. I can't really look at like any 3D, like the Magic Eye or even like the 3DS for long periods of time without it causing a little bit of a headache. Now, with like the first person and like that type of experience, I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on like the Oculus Rift and how these developers are trying to push the immersion factor more with game development these days?
So, the first time I used the Oculus Rift was for a game jam at our studio. Somebody had bought the very first Oculus Rift as I think part of the Kickstarter or something, and we made a quick demo and I could not spend more than 5 minutes, and it just threw me off so horribly. The way that it was calculated was weird, the way it fit on my head was weird, and it was really, really hard. Now with the actually we just got a DK2, so I haven't yet played with that yet, but I'm going to soon. It's supposed to be a bit better in terms of eye tracking, and I know that they are developing, both Valve and Oculus are developing these systems that will map to where you are. So I think the problem is like when I move separately, like than my head does, that's where the big problem comes. So like if I am turning around and everything sort of maps proportionally with my eyes, I'm okay. So if I like am in a room and it's tracking where I am in proportion to the room, it's totally fine. I won't get motion sickness. But if I have to, move a mouse or, WASD or something to, look around something, that's where it gets really bad. That disconnect between the physical moving and where I am in relation.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Julia, about that disconnect. And that's one of the things I'm sort of worried about with the Rift. For those of you who haven't listened to previous casts, then you know that I'm one of those guys who I'm a little apprehensive about just how big the Rift is going to be. While my co-host Ken, he is, the Oculus Rift supporter, the lover. If he was here, he would be having like a 20-30 minute conversation with you about the Rift and all that.
I have definitely heard from many people about, the Rift and if it's going to be the next big thing or not. And one of the problems with the room-based is just what, I don't have any more motion sickness, which is amazing because I can play these like first-person viewpoints and not get sick anymore, but I'm constantly also running into the walls. So it's just the only other problem with it. But I don't know, I think maybe it could get better. And it would be cool to be able to play Call of Duty for more than 20 minutes, because I really like Call of Duty, but I can't play for more than 20 minutes. So.
Yeah. And with the Rift itself, it's definitely interesting about, as you said, Julia, how they've been trying to smooth out these wrinkles and fix these general issues with it. Because I know, I believe, when Ken was on the cast, when he had, like, the very first, like, DK model of it, he was saying that those types of issues were there, and they have been improving on it. So it will be interesting to see, whenever it does come out, how the general market will accept it. Now, going back to Mushroom 11 and Untamed, one thing that I want to bring up, and this is for developers who may be listening to the cast, is how Untamed and Mushroom 11, you guys were funded by the Indie Game Fund, correct?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
For people who may not know what that is, could you explain a little bit about what that was and how it has affected Untamed and Mushroom 11's development?
Sure. So Indie Fund is a group of successful indie developers, Jonathan Blow, Ron Carmel, and others. And they basically approach developers whom they think have an interesting game and will ask them if they want to be a part of Indie Fund. And basically Indie Fund is it's like a funding, but it's also like a loan. So they give us money, and of course we have to pay that money back plus interest. Mm-hmm. But it's a great way for indies to be, you know, to stay independent. So it's prevented us from having to go to an investment or a VC, which can, you know, sort of prohibit what we can do with the game that we make. For example, if we go to a VC, they might be like, oh, you have this great game. Now you have to put in microtransactions or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is just a way to prevent that from happening. And also, it's a way that we don't have to delay production because we have to take contract work or something. So it's really nice.
Yep. And the options for any developers with funding has really grown over the last few years. As you said, Julia, with Indie Game Fund is a big one. And of course, there's this whole crowdfunding Kickstarter explosion that has happened.
Yeah. It's been really interesting to see how successful Kickstarter is for indies. I don't know. I guess I have mixed feelings on Kickstarter just because I've seen some developers really work hard on the Kickstarter. So I think the idea is, like, if you do a Kickstarter, you're basically taking out a month of your time on development, because it mm-hmm. really takes a whole month of your time focusing on the viral part of the Kickstarter, like, you know, getting mm-hmm. enough people to see it, getting enough people, you know, to buy into the buzz or the hype, and then giving you enough money to sort of make it over the edge of your limit. Mm-hmm. The good thing about that is you could tell, like, how much people are interested in your game, and you have, like, a user group basically automatically following you because they've already bought into your game, which is pretty amazing. So those things are definitely pluses. I just think indies have to sort of weigh in, you know, what are the costs for the rewards? What are the costs for running this, taking, like, a month out of, you know, in terms of development time? And, you know, what do we get in exchange? You know, do we get a good user base? Do we get enough money to sort of push us over into developing it for another, you know, X number of months or whatever?
Yep. And I would say with, like, Kickstarter, you actually have to spend more than just the month to make, like, a really good Kickstarter. We've seen developers take, you know, several months, maybe even a year out of their time, you know, maybe part-time or just, like, in their spare time working on the Kickstarter and get everything set up. I would say a good example of that would be the developer Red Hook Games and The Darkest Dungeon. When I spoke to them earlier this year, they basically said they spent 6 months researching and planning out their Kickstarter campaign before even getting it on there.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, in a way, it's sort of good because a lot of indie developers don't nearly spend enough on marketing and PR and getting their game out there. And so I think a lot of maybe what overlaps with Kickstarter overlaps with just the general, you know, getting people to know about your game and, you know, making trailers and making GIFs and sending, you know, publications, you know, info about your game. And all of this takes so much work, but it's so important. So that's really interesting that they spent 6 months, but I definitely don't, you know, I can believe that that would take that much time.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we're also seeing that's sort of causing some trouble with Kickstarter is the fact that a lot of consumers are becoming a lot more risk adverse over the prospect of funding these games. Mm-hmm. We've seen, you know, Double Fine, Planetary Annihilation, and a whole bunch of examples of Kickstarters that either failed to produce something or the Kickstarter was canceled for, you know, less scrupulous reasons we've had.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely Kickstarter is not like pre-order, but I think also that could work to a developer's advantage as well, because people are more willing to support a Kickstarter perhaps than, let's say, a pre-order if they think that the pre-order might not be the game that they like or might, you know, take too long to come out. I feel like, you know, while that's true and consumers are getting a bit more risk adverse, they still view Kickstarter as a way to like be a part of something or help support something that they want to see versus maybe a straight up pre-order where it's more like you get money for a game thing instead of you're supporting an indie team.
Yeah. And I think that distinction is very important when we start talking about early access and what has happened with Steam over the last year, maybe 2 years of that program, and just how people view games on there a lot differently compared to Kickstarter. And as you said, Julia, when you have that pre-order mentality versus that donation mentality, it affects the perception and just the entitlement that the consumer feels over what they should be getting from that product.
Yeah, it's a different relationship. And early access is also kind of strange because I feel like that's basically a launching. There are some games where I, you know, I'm like, oh, that game launched. And it's like, no, it's still early access. It's the blur between early access and launch is very, like, yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, and that's another really good point. I mean, for this year alone, I have like 3-4 games I'm actively watching that I can't wait to actually play, but they've all been in early access. And you sort of have to temper your enthusiasm of saying, you know, do I play this game now? Or do I just let it sit and wait for, you know, the flag go up saying, hey, it's done.
Yeah. Do you wait to get the full experience or do you, you know, jump right in and enjoy it, but it might be buggy and crash or...
Yeah. Now, for you, Julia, do you find yourself generally playing early access games, or do you wait for the product to be finished before jumping in?
I think it depends on the game. I usually wait until it's finished before I jump in, just because I feel so backlogged already with games, and so I don't really have that problem of... You know, there are definitely games that I'm watching and I can't wait for them to be released, but definitely I have way too many that I still am playing that I need to get through. So I think it's just a matter of time and, you know, how many games I want to play.
Definitely. I mean, that is an issue I think that's facing a lot of people just with how many games are being released these days. That's becoming a lot harder to really justify spending either more money or playing games in early access. I mean, I still have backlogs from, you know, 2-3 Steam summer sales, Black Friday, the whole deal. And while we're sort of laughing, this is becoming a more pressing issue for either indie developers and AAA guys by the sheer fact that when you have all these games coming out, it's a lot harder to justify spending $50, $60 on a game now when you can wait, you know, 2-3 months and maybe get it for $20, $30 less.
Yeah, and it's also just, there's so much noise out there because there's so many games coming out. It's hard to, you know, stick out of the crowd, even if you have a really good game and even if you get a lot of press, it's becoming harder and harder. And so, yeah, it's a real challenging environment. But I also think that that is changing development, too, of games. I feel like before, developers might have felt guilty, like putting out a game that maybe only had 7 hours of gameplay or so. But I feel like that's actually becoming more respected now that people are like, yeah, I'd rather have like a well-crafted 5-hour game than like a maybe blown up sort of grinding 20-hour experience.
Definitely. And another part of that is the time and, you know, money component of making a 30, 40-hour game versus a game that's, you know, 5, 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this with a lot of indie development, that one of the great advantages is that indie developers can focus on these very refined, very high-quality games that may be only 3, 4 hours long, but it's going to be a very memorable 3, 4 hours long. A great example that would probably be Gone Home from last year, which won, you know, numerous awards for its storytelling. But a game like that, you literally couldn't play it for 20, 30 hours. There's just not enough there. But what is there was enough to really stand on its own. And when we spoke with Chris Park from Arkham Games, he talked about how the studio's decision to sort of shift to making a more refined game versus, you know, that 80-100-hour masterpiece has really helped their studio. Because as you said, Julia, because of the discoverability factor, if you spend, you know, 3-4 years working on this epic 50-hour masterpiece, but then no one finds and plays it, you know, what are you going to do then? If you can make these smaller focused titles, it'll be a lot easier for people to get it and play, and it'll be a lot easier to find it, and you're not tying up so much of your money and energy into those massive projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Now, going back to Mushroom 11, speaking about this discoverability issue with between like the mobile development and the PC or indie development space, was that sort of a factor for both of you in terms of releasing Mushroom 11 on the PC verse as opposed to the mobile?
You mean first?
Yeah.
You mean in terms of discoverability or?
Yeah, in terms of being able to get the game in front of people and having them be able to find it.
So I think, I mean, it's developed in Unity, so it's pretty easy to port to different platforms. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, getting it on a tablet versus on, you know, the Mac is pretty easy.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, we have two whole, you know, code bases, one for like tablet and one mm-hmm. for PC. So that allows us more freedom in terms of like where we would like to go first. In terms of discoverability, I think mobile's really, really hard. I think maybe PC is a little easier. Just because the, you know, consumer base is so different on those two platforms. I feel like, you know, Steam has any of the, you know, different platforms for, you know, downloading computer games caters to, you know, people who are more enthusiastic about games. They'll mm-hmm. like go out and look for games. They'll support indies. They sort of know what indie is. Whereas in the mobile space, I feel like you don't really get that. You get like casual players. You'll get people who might not know what indie is or might not care and might not really care about, you know, trying to find different or interesting games. They just might want to kill some time with whatever is the most popular thing available.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you brought that up, Julia, regarding the different platforms. Because one thing that I noticed with Mushroom 11, on the website itself, you have it priced at $20 for the PC version. Mm-hmm. Now, when you decide to take it to the mobile devices, is that price point going to be changed for the mobile or the casual market?
I think it has to be, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's definitely a big reason of why we are going with desktops first. You know, it's really interesting to see like the perception between those two platforms are really influential in how people view the games. Even if they're the same game across those two platforms, they're viewed very differently, right? Which is just very bizarre and kind of unfortunate mm-hmm. for indie developers or for developers who want to do really interesting and cool things. And I mean, that's a known thing, right? I mean, like when Monument Valley decided to charge content for, you know, their new stuff, they had all this backlash exactly. about like, why are you charging money? $3? What the hell?
Yeah.
You know, it's like $3. Oh my God. You know?
Yeah. And we're sitting here, you know, with the PC. I mean, I just bought, you know, $20 game here, $40 game here. And, you know, when I see a game for like $5, $10, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe it's that cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
And then on the mobile market, it's like $5 for a game. You know, you're a greedy bastard. How dare you charge that much?
It's so weird. And you know, obviously, there's a problem with, you know, trying to go the other way, or it, which is, again, it's just really crazy. Like, you know, the fact that you can put your game on tablets somehow cheapens your game is mm-hmm. just really bizarre. But that's sort of the perception of what mobile is. It's just really weird.
Yep, and it's definitely an issue that we're seeing, as you said, Julia, with that transition from mobile to PC or PC to mobile. Have you heard of the game, I think it's called Plague Inc., that's on the mobile right now?
Yes, mm-hmm, of course.
Yep, and they've, of course, had that issue. They have the Early Access version on Steam right now, and they keep getting, you know, complaints and people saying, you know, why are you charging $20 for the PC game when I can get it for free on the mobile? But The mobile version, of course, has all the in-app purchases, the microtransactions to get that content.
Right.
While the PC is just the flat-out $20, it's yours, you get everything.
It's really funny how people are quick to point out how evil free-to-play is, but it's really the only way you can make, you know, decent money. And it also kind of sucks because it sort of pushes game design in a really kind of... Well, I mean, it works for some games and it could be cool for other games, but it does encourage different types of game design that isn't necessarily the best experiences for players. But it's sort of forced because, you know, whenever people try to like have really great crafted experiences, like one of the examples is this game that recently came out called Framed. It's a beautiful game for mobile. And, you know, it got a bunch of, you know, low reviews because it's like, how dare you charge $4? And I'm like, it's like, you know, this beautiful crafted game. And that would be, you know, you could charge like so much more money for it if it were anywhere else, but like on mobile. So it's really strange.
Yeah, and it's a really good point made, Julie, about how free-to-play has worked for the mobile market, but it comes at that cost. And it's really weird. As you said, it's funny how the cost sort of affects that mentality. I mean, yes, a free-to-play game costs you $0 up front, but you may end up spending, you know, $30, $40 when everything's all said and done, you know, to get through all the in-app purchases and buy all the content.
Right. I mean, that market is totally relying on whales, which are, you know, 1% to 3% of the market who download games, but they will spend hundreds of dollars a month on these in-app purchases. And they sort of fund the rest of the players who will never purchase anything in the game. That's sort of how they're set up. They're set up exactly to be like that. And, you know, it's sort of exploitive on one end. And it's just, you know, on the other end, it's like a lot of people getting stuff for free. So it's a weird way to look at that.
And when we spoke with John Schaefer a few weeks ago regarding his strategy game at the Gates, he talked about a lot of troubles he's had with, you know, this whole devaluation of the game market and how he's pricing the game at $30, which he's even gotten complaints from PC gamers saying that's too much. And he knows that that game, no matter how great it is, would never work on the mobile market. Because there's no way he could charge, you know, 50 cents, a dollar, or even make it free to play and have it work for him.
Right.
And as you said, Julia, when you start having these price tags, it seems to really set off the mobile market, especially the Monument Valley example, which I haven't played it, but I have heard that it comes, you know, it's free to play, gives you a size amount of content to begin with, and then the additional stuff is essentially, you know, like a mini expansion. And, you know, for a PC gamer like myself, you know, that sounds perfectly reasonable. But then when you have this mobile market that is so entrenched with this free-to-play and getting as much, you know, bomb dollar out of everything that they have, it really, you know, can upset the industry and really mess with a lot of developers' profit margins.
Right. I actually also think it's really interesting in terms of like a, it's like an economic... Oh man, I'm totally blanking on the terminology for this industry. It's like psychology based on economics, right? It's like if you have like a $20 wine and a $10 wine, they're going to taste very different, even though it could be the exact same wine out of the same bottle. But you just told somebody this one comes out of a $20 one and this one comes out of a $10 one. It's sort of this relationship of like a price association. And I think that developers are trying to price upwards more, just to, you know, because one, we have to support ourselves, and two, because you do have this association with, you know, if I start a game at a certain price, you know, I could discount it, but at least like it's sort of started at that price value. Does that make sense? So like there are some games that I've seen, actually just a recent game that came out on Steam. It's for like $35. And actually, the funny thing is, when I first saw it, I didn't know it was an indie game. I thought it was a AAA game, just because I was like, oh, it's $39.99. Like, that's obviously a AAA game, right? You know, I didn't think that like, oh, indies could ask for that much. But so it's just really weird that prices can change your assumption towards something.
Yep, and that's one of the things that we're seeing with like the AAA development. There's a recent study by GameStop where they polled their consumers about how much they're spending on digital downloads versus what they expect the pricing to be. And they found that a lot of people feel that a game should be $35 at most if you're buying it digital. And this is definitely becoming, I think, more of a pressing concern as this decade goes on. And as you said, Julia, with, you know, that price perception, a $40 indie game is definitely one of the more stranger things I've heard. There's a whole, you know, hubbub over Prison Architect when they were releasing at $30 for the game. And, you know, people going, you know, why are you charging so much? You know, it's never going to sell. And they've really broken, you know, all the norms for pricing and really just like development strategy for their title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to try to, you know, weigh, you know, if I lower my price, how much more people will buy versus, you know, if I don't. And
Now, with Mushroom 11, as we said a few minutes ago, it's going to be priced for the PC at $20. Mm-hmm. When you do decide to release it on the mobile, have you started to think about what you're going to set the price as, or even like changing its monetary model?
We're definitely not changing its monetary model, just because the game won't work with free play, right? It just won't. Yeah. It's a puzzle game. People don't like to pay for extra content. And so it's definitely something that we're going to have to do premium with. And yeah, it's going to be, I mean, we don't have a price, but we know obviously we can't sell it for nearly as much as we could in Steam. So what we would have to do instead is, you know, make sure that the Steam version, you know, always gets the first content. So like when we decide to port it to mobile, we'll be doing a game update for Steam. So they'll get, you know, new content, and the mobile will only get the stuff that you could have gotten for if you downloaded it on Steam, or if you downloaded it, you know, on what other site you could get games downloaded from. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to figure out, like, you know, can we do $9? I don't know. Maybe we can, maybe we can't. You know, I don't see us being like, here's a game for $2.99. I mean, that's clearly not what we're going to do. So we just have to sort of figure out, maybe in a year it'll change, and maybe mobile, it becomes more acceptable that if you want quality, we'll spend money on it. Maybe that will change slightly as we get into the next year. I don't know. It's a good question mark.
Yeah, I don't know either. And that's what a lot of developers are really questioning. Because as you said, when you have two games on two very different platforms, you're always going to have those people saying, you know, why should I buy on this when I can buy it on that, and vice versa. And I think a part of the problem is really educating the consumer base. Because as we said a few minutes ago, a lot of the mobile market are either casual fans or people just really looking for, you know, a 5-minute time killer. Or they're just going to look at newest release, buy that or try that and be done with it. But when you go to the PC and, you know, especially like the Steam audience and a lot more core gamers, these are the people who take the time to do the research and follow these companies and really become the fans and support them beyond just this release. And when you have a developer who can leverage their fan base like that, it really goes a long ways towards building a successful product and a successful brand.
Right.
Now, with Mushroom 11, as we said, when you're going to think about that mobile to PC transition, do you see you guys like removing levels or shortening the experience at all? Or do you think you're going to keep it at, like, in terms of the actual like release versions, keep them generally the same?
I apart from, you know, making sure that the download from PC is, you know, the most up-to-date version, I'm not actually sure what we're going to do in terms of the mobile version that we come out with. I don't know if we will, you know, limit levels or not. I'm not sure we have that.
Okay.
So, no, wait, what?
All right. Now, as you guys are planning for the PC version, do you see yourselves trying to get on, like, early access or greenlight with Mushroom 11? Or do you see it as going to be a just, like, a standalone release that's going to be out in its full version, basically?
So it's already greenlit on Steam. And I'm sorry, what was the question?
I was going to say, are you going to look at like early access in terms of either getting the game quote unquote out early, or will you just, when it's finished, just release it as its full and ready version?
Oh, okay. So we're not gonna be doing early access, just because, again, it's a puzzle-based game, so it's kind of hard to have a lot of replayability. So we've started pre-orders on our site, and the pre-order unlocks the first level version or demo of the game. It's very short in relationship to the whole game, of course, but it gives players a sense of what to expect when they get the rest of the game. But we're not doing any early access just because it's a puzzle game, so the content isn't very replayable. So early access probably wouldn't work for us.
Yep, and that is definitely a good point, Julia, and smart decision from you guys regarding that, because we see a lot of developers tend to rush into early access. And this also, going back to the whole mobile market and discoverability, Greenlight and early access has also become sort of this massive, blob of games trying to find, the latest stuff. And it can generally confuse people when you're trying to sift through, dozens of games all vying for your attention.
Definitely. And I mean, I think early access is smart for certain games and certain developers. So, like, if you have a multiplayer game, early access is probably really important because you need to get that fan base and you need to get people engaged in playing with each other in order to like start creating that community. And then, sort of, one thing that we're finding kind of difficult is, we don't have that sort of replayability, and so it's kind of hard to, get people to, talk about the game or comment on it when it's like, oh, we have this game, but we can't really let you play it. It's, I mean, a lot of other puzzle games have done, demos and things, and they've been pretty successful. So, but yeah, I think it's a little harder with content that's more puzzle based than.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we see the same thing with the adventure genre as well. Then when you have a game built around a very strict length, strict duration, you can't really, have an early access where people are going to play test it because they're going to see the whole thing. Or what you do is you have to, cut, a quarter of your game, say, okay, this is the early access version, and you can't see the rest until the game is out. And then you just start to confuse people more. And, that can come back to bite you when it's time to actually say, okay, the game is done. Here's the, quote unquote, release version of it. Now, with Mushroom 11, as you said at the beginning of the cast, that you have, I think you said, 7 more months of development left before you're going to release it. Have you guys thought about, like, post content in terms of new puzzles, new modes, anything like that?
We've thought about secret unlocks, more content that we would be putting up with different versions of the game post launch. I don't know. I'm not. I guess I'm not sure. How much more content or levels versus doing a sequel or something. I guess it just depends on how the game does and what the reception is.
Cool. Now, have you, at Untamed, have you guys thought about like what your next project will be or any future plans beyond Mushroom 11's development?
I'm not sure. I think we want to focus on maybe some smaller games because Mushroom 11 has been in development for 3 years now, and it's going to be going on 3.5 years. So it would be nice to do like smaller projects. I know I definitely would like to try more narrative and social issues sort of focused games, but I have no idea what they're gonna look like.
Yeah, I mean, as we said, it's so hard to really gauge the market at this point to say, what would be a very profitable game, just because it's so hard to decide, where the fan base is going to be, how you're going to price it, etc. But it does sound like Mushroom 11 is going to be a really interesting game to check out when it does get released. And I do wish you guys the best of luck on that, by the way.
Thank you.
We are at just about 50 minutes in terms of recording. Are there any other topics or questions you would like me to like bring up about Mushroom 11 or Untamed for you?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I'm
Let's
trying
see
to
that
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything
You guys, are
else.
something you want me to bring up?
No, you actually covered everything. I'm
Okay.
sorry. I had to be on another
This
dev
is Itai, my
Yeah, see
Aita.
how you're doing. I try to listen as much as I could, and obviously Julia was on top of everything. But yeah, I was just talking to the artist, and we're working on another boss. So things are moving rapidly. And yeah, you asked maybe,
anything you wanna
add? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the pre-order. I think you talked about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You sounded like you covered everything. So.
Yeah, I don't know. This is a lot of firsts for us. So.
Oh yeah.
Or at least for me, because I'm a developer, and this is like my first time trying to market stuff, and it's just so, it's like throwing darts in the air or scratching off lotto tickets. That's how it constantly feels.
Throwing darts at lotto tickets.
Yeah. And that's what we hear from a lot of indie developers. I mean, the indie market has really grown to the point where it's become very easy for, you know, anyone or any group of people to really, you know, start up and form themselves as a studio compared to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where you need, you know, a 20, 30 man team, your own studio space in order to have any chance at putting out a game.
I mean, that's great, because hopefully it gets different people into the industry making games about different things. I think we're already starting to see that, but it's really great that that's happening more and more often, and I think it needs to happen more often. But at the same time, it's like, there's so many games now. How do you, like, you know, hey, look at me. Why do I exist? You know, it's really challenging.
Yep. And again, it goes back to this indie market where it's very hard to have, you know, the standard indie experience because everyone is so different. Mm-hmm. And then, as both of you say, it really is like shooting darts at lottery tickets in terms of just trying to figure out, you know, what do we do as a studio? You know, there's no manual, there's no guidebook in terms of indie development. We've seen like 1-2 man teams. We've seen a group of 10 guys get together and form their own studio. There really isn't the quote unquote exact way to become a game developer these days.
And if there was, then it'd be easy and everyone would
be it. I think people are under the assumption lately that there is. And that's why you see a lot of people getting into indie, just thinking that this is a gold rush kind of thing. And we're in there and we see that it's actually... If I keep saying I'm a little bit more of the negative person between us, and I keep saying that if you're in it for the money, then you're probably not going to make any.
Yeah, and definitely a good point to you about that. I mean, we hear this from a lot of developers. There's definitely that push between making a quality product versus making something that's, you know, intent to sell. And as Julia brought up earlier, you know, the whole whales attraction of the mobile market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that this is something that I've been thinking about lately, that if you're thinking your profit structure is going to be on, you know, 1% of your fan base, you're not really building a sustainable game or something that's going to last.
Or, you can, but you need a lot of resources already. So I think, like, if indies want to somehow make the kind of, like, games that are like Candy Crush, it's just impossible, because you can't compete with spending, like, you know, $30,000 a month on advertisement. I mean, you just, or like, you know, it just...
remember that talk you gave at the New York Games Conference?
Oh, yeah. All right, so in New York, we have a big indie community, but we also have a lot of marketing and advertisements for AAA kind of focused in New York. So I went to this game conference about marketing, and the people there were all sort of AAA. And one of the talks was just really interesting, because the guy was like, oh, what if you're an indie studio, like the people that make the Crytek engine, and you only have $100,000 for marketing for a few months? And it's just like, what? That's indie? How is that indie? How in any, like... So it's so funny that, like, you know, these, you know, even King and these casual game studios like Zynga, they still have a lot of money. So if you want to make games that are like the next Candy Crush, you have to compete against people that can throw hundreds of thousands of dollars in advertising every month. I mean, our subway system is plastered with, like, Candy Crush soda ads, you know, which is, you know, fine. But if you're an indie, you probably are like, okay, let's not target that audience, right? Because that's already sort of stamped out.
Yeah, and that's a really good point regarding the advertising side of things. And as you said, Julia, most indie developers don't have, you know, hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars of money to throw.
Hundreds of dollars.
And I mean, as a good case in point, there's been that whole commercial campaign with that game with, I think, Kate Upton doing, I think it's like another like Farmville or Clash of Clans clone. But I can't even imagine how much money that's going to be in terms of advertising for that. I think it's even going to be shown the Super Bowl. You know, there is no way in hell any developer would have the budget for, you know, a Super Bowl commercial. And as you said, if you're trying to compete with, you know, a Candy Crush Saga or Farmville, it's not so much about competing with them design-wise, it's about competing with them in terms of market awareness and advertising. And most indie developers really don't have a leg to stand on there. They just don't have that funding.
And I think most indie developers wouldn't want to do that. Or if they do that route, they're going to do it in some sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of way where they take Candy Crush and turn it on its head or take Farmville and turn it on its head. There's lots of games like that that have been pretty successful. But yeah, it's if you want to be serious about going after that kind of, you know, genre or game, it's, it becomes much more difficult.
Yeah. And I think a good point about sort of approaching like the PC audience, especially like the Steam fans, is the fact that when you have those educated customers who will do the research and find the games, they can basically give you free advertising just by telling their friends, or hell, even the whole Steam creator feature that has really shown a lot of promise over the last few months of getting that discoverability out there for your game. Because there, instead of you trying to compete with King or trying to make this very mobile or very monetized game, you can make the game that you want, and if it is of high quality, people will talk about and your name will get around.
Yeah, and I think that frees you up to make the kind of things you want to make as an indie, like and start making experiences that are different and experimental and or change or comment on the larger culture or whatever. And you can find these really great experiences that just can't exist on mobile just because there isn't the support like there is on Steam. So, you know, in some ways, these, you know, dedicated fans, they deserve better quality because they are supporting people and saying they're voting with their dollars, right?
Yeah.
They're going to be like, hey, look, we like, you know, these types of experiences. Like, we like Papers, Please, and we like Gone Home, and that's great. Like, you know, that's a great experience versus, you know, getting another Candy Crush or getting another
Farmville
or Clash of Clans or, you know, card trading games or...
Yep. And I think as we've said over the cast, there's that real question mark about how the market is really going to change or stay over the next decade or even over the next year regarding this mobile, you know, this rush to the mobile market, rush to monetization versus like the quality or the very niche experiences. As you said, like Papers, Please, Gone Home, stuff like that. And I think it's one of those questions we really don't have the answer for, because it really is going to be dependent on the market perception and just how things are going to grow or change from here.
Right. And I think the hope is that eventually those, you know, mobile users are going to realize that, like, maybe there are other experiences that they would like to have that aren't just these set of experiences that are in the top 10, you know, download free game. So, you know, they might start demanding, like, you know, better quality, and they might start voting with their dollars. Maybe after a while they'll be like, you know what, I'm tired of freemium because it just means I download a game and you ask me for money all the time. I'd rather just pay $3.99 and get it over with, you know, just give me your experience and don't bother me. Maybe that'll start to happen more often as people mature in their discoverability and you know, becoming gamers.
Yep, definitely. And I think that's a great point to end on, and because I think we've really had a great discussion here.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you. We touched on a lot of really interesting problems and issues with the game industry. So.
Yep, definitely. So before we end the cast, do you or Itay have any final thoughts or anything you just want to say about either Untamed, Mushroom 11, or anything like that?
So just, I guess, to clarify, we have two other great people on Mushroom 11, Simon Kono, who is our artist, and Kara Kono, his wife, who is our producer. They are doing an amazing job in both keeping us on top of what we're doing and making the game look beautiful. So thanks to them. And I think that's it.
Awesome. Well said. So I think with that, we're going to wrap things up for the Perceptive Podcast. Julia, it was definitely a pleasure talking today. And if Vitaly's listening, it was great talking to him as well.
It was great. Thank you so much for having us on.
Yep, not a problem. And as I said a few minutes ago, I do wish you guys the best of luck with Mushroom 11, and I can't wait to check it out when it's ready.
Thanks.
All right. So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap up the Perceptive Podcast this week. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, for either being a guest on the podcast or writing a guest piece on the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. And to contribute to our Patreon campaign for funding for Game Wisdom, you can find all the information for that under the Patreon banner, and both are located on the front page. Thank you for listening to the podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.